And thank you very much indeed for that. Now, yesterday, central Paris was practically in lockdown, with tourist sites such as the Eiffel Tower, the Louvre, etc., and businesses along the Champs-Élysées all forced to close. And this was the fourth weekend of protests right across France, in the worst unrest to hit the country in decades. Yesterday alone saw 1,700 arrests. Well, with an update, I'm joined by Sophie Pedder, who's Paris Bureau Chief of The Economist. Sophie, how did yesterday play out?
Well, there was a lot of concern ahead of the day that it was going to be as bad as the previous Saturday. So, you know, in some respects, there was a bit of relief that it wasn't quite as dramatic and quite as violent. But, you know, you mentioned the number of arrests. There were still... The city felt like a sort of... It was, you know, in some respects, just there were scenes that you've not seen in Paris really for decades. Police, riot police everywhere, armoured vehicles, not military ones, but riot police vehicles, crowds that were sort of playing cat and mouse with the police, some cars burned, a sense of siege in a way, a lot of shops boarded up that had been shops that had been sort of ransacked the previous weekend, had learnt their lesson, so they were completely boarded up, cafes shut, museums shut. So it was a very strange sense of sort of a ghost town, but also a city under siege, but less dramatic than the previous weekend. And I think that that's, you know, if you're looking for some sense of, you know, perhaps a trend towards things calming down, it was that the numbers were, there were fewer people on the streets, and there was unrest, but it was less excessive and less extreme than the weekend before.
And of course, they won in the sense that the tax hike on diesel was abandoned. And there's an irony there somehow that we talk about climate change and the Paris agreements, and one of the things that's going to arise because of the Paris agreements and because of climate change is that it's going to be very difficult for all of us to have diesel cars and to get cheap fuel. Like, that's an inevitability.
I think this is exactly one of the issues that France is grappling with. You know, we have a president here, President Macron, who was elected on a sort of climate, anti-climate change platform. And he has, do you remember the slogan, make our planet great again, which he used? And he has wanted to make the fight against climate change very much part of the identity of his presidency. But it's very difficult because everyone likes the idea of fighting climate change, but nobody likes the taxes that inevitably go with it. And it's very difficult, the problem was, of course, for him that he was hiking taxes on fuel at exactly the time when the world oil price was rising. So the cumulative effect of that was pretty intense for people who are on tight budgets, and that's what really sort of tipped people over the edge, and that's what started the protest. So it is very difficult to get it right. I mean, you have to, the timing has to be right, and there has to be some sort of compensation of, you know, the difficulty in France, of course, was it was people who felt that they were already being sort of overtaxed and hadn't seen anything much in terms of tax cuts, who were feeling that this was, you know, the one tax that pushed them over the edge. So it reminds
what we had. Very complicated things like that over our water charges. I mean, I see the language being used, the straw that broke the camel's back, and that was certainly used here on the water charges. I'll come back to you in a moment, but can I just go to you, if I may, Seamus, because I think this is very relevant. If you take the pain that's going to come with dealing with climate change, and there's no point in pretending that it's not going to be painful. Farmers are going to have to make terrible sacrifices. Fuel is going to get hammered. That means anybody that doesn't live in an area with public transport is going to, and nobody is going to like any of these things. And I mean, they don't like it in France, they don't like it in America, they don't like it anywhere.
Yeah, and I suppose something similar happened here in advance of the budget when there was discussion about raising the carbon tax in Ireland, and people were making exactly those points you set out there about the impact of that, and the language seemed to be about mitigating features. Could you introduce a tax on carbon and then have something to offset it on the other side, maybe income supports, other areas that might reduce the impact on the person's overall livelihood, while then changing their behaviour just when it comes to the fuel alone. And it is something that is going to become, I suppose, more important as years go on. But one thing about fuel is that it is going to get more expensive, particularly fossil fuel, because it's going to get scarcer and scarcer. And you have volatility in the price. And while maybe the issue in France sort of was triggered by the whole tax on diesel, I think the movement itself has moved well beyond it.
Right. Yeah, well, so I gather, indeed. So if I could go back to you, Sophie. I gather social media played a huge part in these protests.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the accelerated pace at which you can organise things these days. The anger has been around for a while in France, but it was the ability of organisers within a matter of weeks to get together petitions online and using Facebook in particular as a way of organising, so that the numbers came very fast. The organisation took place at record speed, and it really caught everyone off guard, especially in government, because precisely of that speed. And one of the ironies, of course, is that, you know, Emmanuel Macron himself was elected on the back of organising, creating a new party, also in record speed, and also on the back of social media. And so, you know, he is sort of seeing his own techniques now being used against him, because it just makes it all so much quicker to organise, given that tool is now available.
Now, you wrote the book on Macron. What's going to happen to him now?
Well, it is his first political crisis, and I mean, I don't use that word lightly. It's something where, you know, after 18 months in which he did actually put into place quite a lot of very much needed reforms, and against, you know, protests before, but this is a very different sort of protest. It's not organised. There are no leaders. It's not like those union street protests that you see in France so often. This is something much more amorphous, difficult to handle, it's difficult to talk to anyone about it. You can't negotiate with anyone because there's no one who's prepared to identify themselves as a leader, willing to talk to the government. That makes it very difficult for him. So it is undoubtedly the first real political crisis, and you've seen that in the sense that he's cleared his diary. I mean, his diary last week he was supposed to be in Serbia for a couple of days. That was cancelled. Almost every meeting has been cancelled as they try and deal with that. That gives you a sense of how intense the pressure is on him. But, you know, French institutions are strong. He was elected. He has a democratic mandate.
Yeah.
And Parliament is he has a majority in Parliament. So, you know, we're not looking at a sort of president about to resign, I don't think. But we are looking at one who is going to have to think long and hard about both the way in which he makes policy, and also I think the way in which he interacts with the French. You know, there's a feeling that he's too remote, too aloof, and I think that's something he's probably going to have to think very hard about.
That's an impression you have too, Dennis, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it seems certainly from a distance that it's partly about his style as of governing, and this remoteness and this sense that he is the president of the rich. But I was wondering, I wanted to ask Sophie,
yes.
How do you think, Sophie, this is going to manifest itself in terms of electoral politics? Who stands to gain, or where is it likely to be channeled?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because you've seen during these protests an attempt by extreme or populist politicians, both on the far left and on the far right, to try and sort of piggyback on the protesters, because for them this is a wonderful opportunity to try and exploit the anti-Macron feeling out there. But what's so interesting about the Gilets Jaunes protesters is that they don't want any politicians to get involved at all. So you've had Marine Le Pen on the far right, you've had Jean-Luc Mélenchon on the far left, who are being rejected almost because they are seen now as part of the establishment, part of the system, which is a fascinating a new phenomenon. It's not obvious at all that the two of them are going to be the beneficiaries. You know, we are living at a time of just incredible fluidity in terms of party politics, not just in France, but it's quite other countries. I mean, I think Italy comes to mind, where you saw exactly that happen, the far left and the far right come together.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, at the moment we're right in the middle of that sort of reorganisation, it's not at all obvious that the parties you would imagine would benefit. in other words, the far right and the far left, are going to. This is an apolitical movement that is fed up with party politics and with establishment politicians altogether.
Well, and that seems to be a pattern across the world. Like, if you take the surprise of Brexit or the success of Trump, a lot of these are perceived as protest against old politics, essentially.
Well, one of the interesting things about the Gilets Jaunes, and again, you see it in Brexit, you see it in Trump, you see it even to a certain extent with the water protests here, is that even though you have the trigger issue of the fuel taxes, there are actually composite movements. So there's a number of different factors. So we talk about Macron's remoteness, we talk about the rural-urban divide in France, which is massive and is getting to be quite significant here as well. And then the whole kind of post-austerity fallout, the particular strata of, you know, the working poor and all those. And it's the combination of those coming together in a particular nexus that creates this kind of fragmentation and social cohesion. And that's what's so interesting about the Gilets Jaunes, is they're very overt about that. That's why they're not talking. They don't want to get back. They don't want to integrate. They don't want to be going under Marine Le Pen's, you know, the fracturing that they want the fracturing, essentially, because that's how they feel. That's representing where they're at. And in a sense, that's the forces that actually we're still seeing even playing out in the UK, and the inability to as you called it earlier, Dennis, a convulsion. This is another convulsion. It's just taking a different form. And that's what's happening all around the world. The cliche all sociologists will say it's neoliberal economic politics. I'm not going to divert from the cliche, but there's no doubt that we're reaching a point where social cohesion is coming under deep strain, I think.
Where do you see matters moving from here? I think it's always very interesting with the French that even if it's inconvenient for them, you will get general support for all strikes. Even if it means, you know, that the metro closes down, the strikers get support. But this is so violent. Is there still that support for them?
Well, I think lots of people expected the support to decrease after the first weekend of violence, for exactly the reason you identify. But what's fascinating is that actually public opinion has stayed behind the Gilets Jaunes protesters. And that's been, and it's a big majority. I mean, it's, depending on the polls, it's sort of two-thirds to four-fifths of French people saying they support the Gilets Jaunes movement.
That's an extraordinary amount, isn't it?
It is extraordinary, and that's really very different from the strikes. I mean, ordinary strikes and ordinary protests, especially over the last 18 months, while Macron's been president of France, actually people have been on his side rather than on the side of the strikes, which has been, which had felt like a kind of new phenomenon. But this, I think the support here is partly because this has become a sort of, not just about the carbon tax anymore, but it's about, you know, the fact that living standards, cost of living, taxes in France, it's a general feeling that, you know, that something's not quite right about the way in which, the benefits or otherwise of the changes that are going on in the world are not being fairly distributed. And I think the French feel that there's a lot of sympathy for people in that situation.
Can I come to you, Dennis? Because I know that you were in Germany for so long for the Irish Times. Is that same convulsion happening in Germany?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly you obviously have difficulties in the German political system because the weakness of the Social Democrats, the rise of the far right. But still, you don't see that same kind of level of unrest or of general unhappiness, I think. You know, obviously the economy is doing well in Germany. There's still, you know, there are difficulties there, but I don't think they're on the scale or of the intensity that we're talking about here.
Sophie, where to now? I mean, what can Macron do? He's done the U-turn. That hasn't really had any material effect. And when is the next time he'll be tested himself?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult for him. The options are not great. I think there are some things he can do in terms of rethinking tax policy and public spending. He said he wants to have sort of consultations over the next few months in which people participate. There is some form of of input from citizens, from the ground, from grassroots organisations in terms of thinking about how French tax cuts or otherwise should fall, and that's one thing. But I think it's also more difficult for him in a way because it's to do with style and it's to do with the way he is, the sort of president he is. He wanted to be this almost de Gaulle-like figure, you know, who it's almost monarchical as well, that sense of France wanting a leader who is strong and projects this sense of grandeur and all of that, which is up to a point true, but I think the French have felt that that went hand in hand with this remoteness, and he's got to address that. I don't think he can connect again with people and try and restore the credibility that he had unless he addresses that issue as well. And the next test for him, of course, is the European elections next May, and that is going to be very difficult. And it's there's even talk at some point of whether the Gilets Jaunes themselves might stand and create some sort of a party. But, you know, we're a long way from that, I think. But you never know. Things can move very fast. But in any case, that vote will be very difficult for him. It will probably turn into a bit of a sort of referendum against on or against his presidency.
Ed, do you want to come in on that?
No, I just wanted to say that the social media achieves two things. One is it also enables a movement to be subverted. And there is a piece in The Independent today. The woman, quote is, the woman behind the yellow jackets, that's the woman who started it off, says the revolt has been hijacked. And that the level of violence this time is qualitatively different than the typical French protests, stopping the metro and air travel and so on. So there's something much more sinister, she's alluding to, behind the scenes, men dressed in black, organised and being ultra-violent in this case. And it'd be interesting to see, I'd be interested as to what is the public reaction to that element. Are people really supporting the level of violence in this case?
Sophie?
I think it's important to make that distinction. People are not supporting the Gilets Jaunes, the violent elements, and there are certainly, the police say that there are infiltrators both on the sort of ultra left and on the ultra anarchist, and they're on the ultra right, or some neo-fascist groups have been infiltrating the movement as well, particularly last weekend. But I think people make a very clear distinction between the sort of justification and the valid protests of people who are standing out there in the cold on roundabouts across France with fires burning and just wanting to make a peaceful protest. Those are the ones the French support. It's not the violence. But what's interesting is that despite that violence, people haven't, the support hasn't reduced, because I think people make that distinction. And as for the Gilets Jaunes themselves, I mean, you know, you mentioned one of the women who was behind some of the early attempts to get people to together. There is a huge problem with who is behind it, who is a leader, who isn't. There are a lot of internal divisions. There was one group of Gilets Jaunes who were happy or in principle to come and talk to government, and there was even a meeting organised with the Prime Minister with them, and then because they got, some of them got death threats from other Gilets Jaunes about the idea of even talking to the government, they then all pulled out of that meeting. So there's a lot of internal rivalries, and it's a completely unstructured movement with all the rivalries and internal sort of divisions that involves. So it's both its strength, but it could also be its weakness.
Right. You expect it to continue on much longer?
I think that the protests themselves, the protesters are still out there on the roundabouts during the week, and we will. They are talking about, you know, continuing all the way up till Christmas. We'll see how the week turns out. I think it will be, Macron is expected to talk to the nation in some form or other, and that will also matter. Whether or not there's anything he can say is a different question, but there is no sense that they want to fold their movement yet.
Right.
I think it's they're pretty determined to keep going all the way till Christmas.
Okay. Listen, thank you very, very much indeed. And that was Sophie Petter, who is Paris Bureau Chief of The Economist. Back after this.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.